I'm Louise Darmody, interviewing Patricia Johnson for the New South Wales State Library's Oral History Collection. Today, Trish will share with us her life story, as well as her experience of the repatriation of Mungo Man and other ancestral remains at Mungo National Park. The interview is taking place at the Wentworth Library at Baronga, New South Wales, on Thursday, the 19th of April, 2018. Trish, can you tell me the day and the place you were born?
I was born on the 21st of 9 51, in Lake Adelico, Austwell. It's 9 miles from Murrumbridge Mission, where I lived.
And can you just tell me, could be a lot of people listening to the story who aren't sure where Murrumbridge is, because it's easy to get it confused with Murray Bridge. Can you tell us where it is?
Murrumbridge is 9 miles from Lake Jellico, and it's about 60 k's from Griffith. It's central New South Wales.
Right. And can you remember the very first time you heard the story about the discovery of Mungo Lady in 1968 and Mungo Man in 1972? The first time you heard any stories? When were the first time you heard people talking about those discoveries? It doesn't have to be an exact date, but just the first stories you heard and who told you those stories.
It was about, maybe a few years ago. I just heard it on the Aboriginal grapevine. Also from relatives and attending meetings.
And what did you think about those discoveries at the time? Do you remember thinking, you know, a big discovery, because it was a worldwide discovery, because at that stage they thought the remains were 20,000 years old and since discovered they're over 40,000 years old now. Was it a surprise to you?
Well, what happened was my family wasn't consulted about the discoveries, because we lived in Murrumbridge. That's where, you know, they thought we came from. So what happened was people did come to Murrumbridge to speak with the people there, but my people weren't contacted. So it wasn't until I arrived back in Pencarry and Baronga that I found out about it, yeah.
And Mungo Man was brought back to Mungo National Park in November last year after being at the Australian National University in Canberra for 45 years. Can you tell me the story about the fight to get Mungo Man's remains back to Mungo National Park? What involvement have you had with it in the big lead-up to him being brought back last year?
Well, what happened was they've been trying to get Mungo Man brought back all these years, and then myself and Michael, we...
Your nephew?
My nephew, we got elected onto the AAG, the Aboriginal Advisory Committee. And from there, we was instrumental in with others in getting Mungo Man brought back.
And how many years have you been involved with that fight?
Well, with bringing Mungo Man back, it's only since I've been on the AAG, but I've been there for what, nearly 30 years. Trying to get recognition for my family to get Mungo Man and Mungo Lady brought back.
And where, what's your family connection with Mungo Man?
Mungo Man and Mungo Lady is our ancestors. Manfred Tommy was born on Manfred Station, and he married Mary Johnson, Manfred Mary and Mary Brodie, the one person. She married three times. And they had six children, and the eldest daughter, Nellie, who is my great-grandmother, she's the eldest daughter for
Eldest daughter of Manfred.
Manfred Mary and Manfred Tommy. And that's where the connection is.
And what was their mob?
Their mob is on Manfred Mary's side, we Parkinji, Darling River people, from Wilcannia down to Para Station. That's near Ashmore Station on the Darling River. That's 20 to 30 k's on either side of the river, like in different areas. And Parinti is where Manfred Tommy is. That's his tribe. And that is where the Wollandra World Heritage Area is, Mungo. And,
And you've got a lovely photo that is now, for people who want to have a look at it, it's on the web on Trove, and it's part of the South Australian Museum's collection. A lovely photo of your great-grandmother, Nellie. Can you tell me what's in the photo?
In that photo that's in the South Australian Museum, that canoe is that original canoe belonging to Granny Nellie, is in the South Australian Museum. And in the photo, there is Granny Nellie, who's standing up in a boat with a pipe in her mouth. And next to her is my grandmother, Ivy, her daughter, second eldest daughter. And then there's Maggie, her eldest daughter. And that's Honey Lottie and Honey Reenie's mother.
And the photo is of Nellie actually standing up and paddling, isn't it? And with a hat on. It's a lovely photo.
It's a beautiful photo.
I advise people to have a look at it because it's a really beautiful photo. And what was she doing at the time? She was paddling her two kids, and you were telling me that she would take people across the river.
Yeah. And, that was their means of transport, the canoe. And, they used to go fishing in it, and in the middle of the canoe is a fireplace, clay fireplace, where they cooked.
And their little kids could sit by the fire and stay warm.
Yeah.
And so getting back to Mungo Man's repatriation and his return to country last year in November, can you describe that day for you, the ceremony out at Mungo National Park? What happened for you that day?
What happened for me was the fact that, we were told by our elders, the Parenti elders, not to go on that trip.
The bus was taking, the other elders went to Canberra and they were bringing back the remains in the Aboriginal hearse, which had Mungo number one on it.
Because, we can't travel to people's country like that. Like, these people took Mungo Man away, so they needed to bring him back, not us. That wasn't our job to bring him back. Our job was to be there at Mungo to receive him and to welcome him back home. And that was our job to do that. And I'm so proud we didn't realise that that it was going to be my grandsons and my sons to put him back on country again. And that was the biggest highlight of my life, our life.
And who were they? What are their names?
There was my son Shane O'Donnell, my grandsons, Raymond Anton, Michael, Michael overseed it, but there was Riley Hannah, Zachary Brennan, and my nephew Wally Biggs.
So it was a very proud day for you.
It was the proudest day of my life because, it was meant to be. Like, it wasn't supposed to happen that way. It was other people that were supposed to be there to take him out of the earth and put him down on country. But the way it happened, it just blew me away. And I'm so proud to be a part. I was so proud to be a part of that. And it made me cry.
And if you were telling your great-grandson this story about that day and he may not have been able to be there, what would you say? So that was a really significant memory for you. Are there any other memories for the day that really you'll never forget?
About the whirlywinds, how they welcomed him home, yeah. And also the feeling of, I don't know, before Mungo Man came back, I had this feeling of sorrow and sadness and I didn't feel, that things weren't completed. But when Mungo Man came back on country, I felt that, he's home again. Now, even though he's not buried in the ground, he's home on country, and that is the main thing, that we've got him home.
And what has it meant to your family, do you think, your other family members?
It blew their minds, It just, they rejoice so much. We all rejoice so much. And we'll never forget how it happened and what happened. Like, we still talk about it, like, nearly every day we still talk about it. It's just a highlight of our lives, We're so proud to be there for him when he came home.
And you are, as you mentioned, the Willandra Lakes Region World Heritage Areas elected in the elected Aboriginal Advisory Group. And your meeting this afternoon and tomorrow, what decisions are you having to make, and what's happening now in relation to Mungo Man and Mungo Lady and the other remains out at Mungo National Park?
Well, we don't want... Michael and I, my nephew Michael and I, we are there on behalf of our elders, who is Annie Lottie, my sister Priscilla Biggs, and my auntie Annie Eunice Hudson. We take orders from them. They are our elders. So whatever they say, we do. And their decisions is that Mungo Man, he is back on country now, but he needs to be put in a safe, secure place and not be exploited by anyone. And the only way that can happen is if he is put in a keeping place, in a vault, in a keeping place. Not only Mungo Man, but the rest of them, Mungo Lady and, the others. And, because... And the only place that is secure and safe is Liaga. Because if we put him back at Junai, there is so much erosion there, and there is no security, there's no safety, there's no... anyone can come in there at any time and take him. You know what I mean? Because we've seen what happened with the footprints. I don't know where that happened. It happened in Australia or somewhere where the footprints were stolen and they were sent overseas. So we don't want that to happen to our ancestors. We are there to protect our ancestors. And if we don't do it, it's bad for us. And we have to make sure that they are safe and secure and not violated.
And you mentioned before that your grandmother, Ivy, was in that kayak, and then your mother was Ivy's daughter. Can you tell me about your mother's other brothers and sisters, who they were? So your grandmother was Grandmother Ivy, and can you tell me about her children?
Well, Ivy had another child to Walter Waddy Clark, and that's Granny Moisey's eldest son, favourite son, and her name is Amy Clark. She married Sonny Quayle, John Quayle.
And who are Betty's other brothers and sisters?
Well, she died in childbirth, my grandmother, Ivy. And I think, it was Nolan was the baby, but I'm not sure of that.
And how many children did she have? Did she have... you told me she had 13 children.
Ivy?
No, Ivy. No, how many children did Ivy have?
She only had three.
Oh, she only had three.
Yeah, and the youngest one passed away young, yeah.
And what do you know, your mother, you were saying before, your grandmother was on Pooncarry Station, and was your mother on Pooncarry Reserve as well?
My mother was born on Pooncarry Mission. My grand-air mother was born on Pooncarry Mission. And air mother, that's Nellie, was born on Pooncarry. And Manfred Mary, she was born at Morara Station.
And so Betty, can you tell me about your mum's childhood? What did she tell you about growing up on Pooncarry Station and then Menindi Station?
Well, she didn't tell us much, and because in those days on the mission, we weren't allowed to speak our language or know about our culture. That was forbidden. But she did say that she went to school on the Pooncarry Mission up till sixth class, I think. Yeah.
And did she like school?
She loved school. She said that they taught her how to play the accordion, the organ, guitar. She could sing. Yeah, she was a top student.
And your sister Esther, who's Michael Young's mother, who I've interviewed for this oral history focus that we're doing on Mungo Man, she was born on Menindi Station, but you were actually born on another station. Can you tell me about where you were born?
Well, the reason why I was born in Murrin Bridge, Lake Jellicoe, was because in 1909, that's when the resettlement was happening in around Pooncarry, and they needed the land for settlement, And because of colonisation, my people were rounded up. Well, not sort of rounded up, but were put on Pankeri Reserve. And because they wanted the land, wanted to farm the land. And what happened was they put them on Pankeri Reserve, and it was my great-grandmother on the white side, her name was Betsy Sharp Fowler. She was a Betsy Sharp Smith Fowler. She married Samuel Fowler. At the time, she lobbied for this reserve to be set aside for the Aboriginal people. Aaron, the policeman at the time, and that's how that came about. And so
they went from... Why did they close down the Pankeri mission?
They closed the Pankeri mission down because they opened up the mission in Menindi.
How far away was that from Pankeri?
About 130 k's. But what happened was they closed down in 1930, I think, or 1933, something like that. And then they round them all up. See, what happened was, that's why there's a lot of confusion these days with where people come from, and that's the reason why is because a lot of people at the reserve, they could come and go as they please. Like on a reserve, you can come and go as you please, there was no manager. But on a station, mission station, there were managers who controlled everything, the Aboriginal Protection Board. Anyways, what happened was Pankeri Mission, it was a safe place for people to be, Aboriginal people to be. And what happened was there was people from all over living at Pankeri Mission. All the different tribes, people from all different tribes went to Pankeri Mission and lived there. Because they used to give them rations and they knew they were safe there. And then when it was closed in the 1930s, Menindi Mission was opened up. And that's when they moved the people from Karara Tank and Rajari people and Dangali, Willikali, like all the different tribes, they moved there to Menindi Mission. And that's how they all got confused with where they all came from.
And did your family tell you any stories about that time? Was that a hard time, that moving from Pankeri to Menindi?
It was a hard time because even though it was still in their own country, in Parkindji country, it was still hard because, yeah, they were so used to being in their own area at Pankeri.
And was it freer or was it less free?
It was less free.
Because it was run by the Aboriginal Protection
Board. There was a manager and assistant manager. And my dad used to work as the handyman on the mission.
And did they have to get permission to, your family have to get permission to go off the station?
I'm sure they did. But I know at Murrin Bridge they had to.
And yeah. So then when did they move to Murrin? When did your family move to... Or when they moved to Murrin Bridge, which was nearly 700 kilometres over near Lake Kajaliko and 100 k's from Griffith. A long way. That must have been a big change for them from to go to Menindi to Murrin Bridge, was it?
Yeah, well, that was part of the government policy to assimilate them.
Did you hear any stories about that big change to go to Murrin Bridge from your family?
Yeah, what happened was they were going to close Menindi Mission down because they wanted to build a weir there and there was things they wanted to do there with, you know, near the mission. And also they did asked if you know, my people wanted to go to Murrumbidgee, but where else were they to go? They couldn't go back to Pincarey because it was already taken over by squatters and settlers, so, yeah.
Did they tell you what it was like in the day-to-day running of Murrumbidgee?
Well, before that, my mum and dad were born. Not born, were married. On the 9th of February at the Menindee Mission. And mum played the organ at our wedding, and she sang the song and played the song, "Where you may lead me, I will go." And, you know, and that was really great, you know. A lot of people were married at Menindee Mission.
Did you have see any photos of her wedding?
Yeah, one photo. It's a black and white photo of her wedding.
What did she look like? Can you describe her dress?
No, I can't because it... But the dress that she wore, she dressed Granny Nelly in it to bury her. This was in 1948 at Menindee Mission. Granny Nelly passed away. And my sister Cilla Biggs and Annie Eunice Hudson, they were there when Aunt Granny Nelly passed away. They were in the room when she passed away. And, yeah, and apparently Mum dressed Granny Nelly in her wedding gown to bury her in her wedding gown. So, yeah, I thought I'd just say that.
Yeah, now that's an interesting little addition to the story. And so your mother married your father. What was his name?
Albert Johnson.
And was
he's a Wiradjuri man.
Was he your dad?
No, he was my stepdad, but he was the only dad I ever knew, so yeah.
And who is your dad?
My biological dad is Alfred Manny and Johnson Upright.
So can you tell me how many brothers and sisters you had?
13.
And where do you come in the pecking order?
In the middle.
And can you just tell me their names?
I'm the one that cops it all. well, there's Esther.
And she's Michael's mother, who
Michael's
I interviewed.
Michael's mother, yeah. Yes.
And she was born at Menindee, wasn't
she? Was
she?
Born in Menindee Mission. Then there was Priscilla. She was born in Menindee Mission. There was Mavis. She was born at Menindee Mission. Doreen, she was born, I think she was born in Menindee Mission. Ralph was born in Menindee Mission. Oh, before Ralph there was Valda. She was born in Menindee Mission. And then there was Ralph, who was born in Menindee Mission. And then Keith, when they moved to Murrumbidgee, Keith was the first baby to be born at Murrumbidgee. That was in 1949, they moved to Murrumbidgee, and that's where Keith was born, my brother. He was born there in 1950, February, I think it was February 1950. And then there was myself.
And what year were you born?
I was born in 1951, and then there was Andy, 1952, and then there was Margaret, Louise, Alan and... No, it wasn't Alan. It was Elizabeth, Daphne, and then Alan.
What an amazing group. And did you have a lot of fun with your brothers and sisters growing up?
Yes, we did, because on the mission, Mum had a vegetable garden, and also she had this huge fig tree. And, oh, the beautiful figs that we used to get off it. And, yeah, she had apricot and peach trees and rhubarb. I never want to eat any more rhubarb because, yeah, she used to make rhubarb pie. She went to pick it out of the garden, rhubarb.
And what sort of things would you do as you were growing up on the station? What are some of the memories of what you did?
Well, we had an old horse called Bawley, one of them old dray horses called Bawley we owned. And about four of us used to get on the back of Bawley and ride down the lane between the houses. And, yeah, we was only kids and, yeah, we used to have fun. We'd go fishing and swimming and go hunting. And I could tell you a story about my brother, Keith. What happened was Mum was in the laundry, she was washing. And, you know, they used to boil the clothes in the copper to make them white. And she hung some of the washing out on the clothesline, you know, the with the prop stick. There's a wire going across. There's two posts and a wire and a prop stick.
To hold up the
hold
wire.
The wire up, to hang the clothes on. She hung the sheets and the napkins, white sheets and white napkins out. And and there was no grass there, no lawn, just dirt. Anyways, this fig tree, my brother, in those days we only had a radio and we used to listen to Tarzan all the time. My brother was mad on Tarzan, Keith. And what happened was he got up on the fig tree and he sung out, we heard him singing out real loud. We were there when it happened. And he sung out real loud, Tarzan. And he jumped onto the clothesline, the swing on the clothesline, and it broke. And he was all covered in in these napkins and sheets, and they all got so dirty on the in the ground, and he knocked himself clean out. So Mum, we sung out to Mum, she ran out with a bucket of water and threw it over him. And he came around and she gave mine. Yeah, but we all got in trouble because, you know, she had to do all the washing again. But, yeah, that's just one little story. But we made our own fun. We used to use the Kwandong seeds to play marbles. We used to have big games around us. And not just the kids, but the whole families. We used to get out in the street and have big game around us. And what's the other one? I can't remember that. But, you know, we made up our own games, yeah.
And you used to go out hunting with your granny. Who was that granny that you used to go out with?
Oh, I used to go hunting with Granny Rosie all the time.
Was she your real granny or was she
No, she wasn't my real granny, but we called her granny, and she was married to my father's brother. She was my auntie, yeah. But we called her granny, and because, you know, she was like a granny to everyone on the mission. But, she was the best shooter in Murrum Bridge. Like, she'd outshoot any man. And we'd go with her in the sulky. And I'd like to read a little story. Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
About Granny Rosie. And, it's 5 pages, then.
Yeah, that's right.
I wrote a story. But I'm a writer. I write short stories about what happened in the past. And this story's about hunting with Granny Rosie. Granny Rosie was as tough as they came, but she always was as gentle as a lamb. She could outshoot any man on the mission. I loved my Granny Rosie. I still remember so clearly all those great times we had together. I loved going hunting with her in her horse and sulky, with the dogs following behind us. Every chance I got, I went hunting with her. I enjoyed helping her saddle up the horse and hooking the sulky up behind the horse and packing up the sulky with our gear. Sometimes she would let me hold the reins while we were travelling along. Granny Rosie always sang songs in her lingo and puffed on an old pipe when we were travelling along. I wished I was able to learn and so I could sing for my children. But in those days, Aboriginal Welfare Protection Board forbid us to learn our language and culture. We had to learn the English language. She would let me hold the reins while we were chasing kangaroos, emus and wild pigs, because she had to hold the rifle and do all the shooting. Granny Rosie always knew when the mulberries were ripe. She would pull up at the huge mulberry tree, which was in the paddock, a couple of miles off the road. It was always loaded with the most sweetest and juiciest mulberries we ever tasted. We'd just sit under the tree and stuff ourselves with mulberries. The juice from the mulberries used to stain our clothes and our hands. Then we'd pick some to take with us. On our way home, we'd call in again to have a good feed of mulberries and pick a heap of them to take home for the rest of the family. Mum would make the best mulberry pie and jam you ever tasted. Granny Rosie always set up camp in our favourite spots not far from the wars and the rivers. She knew when to lay in wait for their pigs, emus, kangaroos and goats, with their rifle near the bore or the river when they'd come into water. It was usually late in the afternoon or early in the morning. She'd always shoot something because she was a crack shot. Sometimes if the emus were too far away for her to shoot, she would whistle them up. She taught me how to skin, gut and cut up the meat. You can't beat lying in a swag next to a fire at night with a contented stomach full of Granny Rosie's dry curried kangaroo, buttered ashes damper and fresh brewed billy tea, looking up at the stars searching for the Southern Cross, Milky Way and the saucepan, etc. Then laying there watching Granny Rosie singing in her lingo, she scrapes the hard-plugged tobacco with her pocket knife and put it in her pipe. She continues singing in her lingo. She puffs on her old pipe while stoking the fire. She would sing us to sleep. We'd put the shrimp tins in the river, set the lines and the rabbit traps just on dark before we went to bed, then get up just on daybreak to check them, then put a huge log on the fire so it could burn all night and there would be fresh coals then for the morning. One of my chores, which I really enjoyed, was to get up before any of them and stoke the fire and go to gather more wood. We usually have fresh fish cooked on the coals or in the camp oven, or scrambled emu eggs cooked in a camp oven with Johnny cakes saturated in butter for breakfast. You just can't beat it. Sometimes during the day we'd catch yabbies in the creeks on meat tied to the end of a piece of cotton. When they'd get on the meat, you wasn't quick enough to grab the yabbies by both legs. They either get away or clamp on your finger. By gee, it hurt. Sometimes Granny Rosie would take us looking for quanlong trees, emu eggs, plover eggs and the bowerbird nests. Granny Rosie knew where the quanlong trees were but used to make out that she didn't know, because when we drive out a certain area she'd tell us to jump out and look around. She would sit there in a sulky smoking her pipe watching us as we walked around looking for the quanlong trees. I'm so sure she was as excited as we were when we found the quanlong trees. She would jump off the sulky, tether the horse and help us pick them. What a good feed we have. We'd pick up enough to last for us, for our camp, and we take home with us for our family. I already said that, didn't I? Yeah. Us kids used to use them to play with marbles. She knew how to track the emus to their nest. When we used to walk around the scrub looking for the nest, she would say to us, always keep an eye out for the emus because they are dangerous and will attack you to defend their nest. We would always be on our guard. We used to find up to 12 emu eggs in a nest. She would always leave a couple of eggs in the nest and make sure that the nest were the same as we found it, so as the emus would have offspring and they would come back and lay their eggs in the same nest next season. If the emus found that the nest had been tampered with, they wouldn't use that nest again and move on to another area. She would show us the signs of where to look for the plover and bowerbird nests. The plover nest would have about 4 eggs in it. After we found enough eggs, we would take them back to the camp and boil them up like fowl eggs. We would take them with us for lunch the next day. It was so exciting finding the bowerbird's nest. You didn't know what to expect to see in the nest because the bowerbirds loved collecting bright, colourful and pretty things. We never took anything from the nest or disturbed them, but only admired their contents. Very seldom we would come across a beehive in a tree. She would pull up a fair way from the beehive and make us stay in the sulky. Then she would smoke the hive and grab some of the honeycomb and get out of there. She could move for an old woman. That night after dinner, when we were all sitting down around the campfire, she would give us some of the honey to suck on. Sometimes when we were out and about, we'd dig some yams, look for witchetty grubs and some snotty gobbles.
What were snotty gobbles?
They were little drops on the gum leaves. Yeah, little white drops. The thing that sticks in my mind about Granny Rosie was the fact that she took the time to actually show and teach us about our culture with gratitude and respect, without payment of any kind. sorry, but I'm sad. Sorry.
That's okay. Would you like a glass of water?
Yeah. Knowing air has enriched my life. Granny Rosie holds a very, very special place in my heart that can never be erased. That is why I've written this story about it, so that she will never be forgotten. Also, I didn't put in that in those days we couldn't afford to buy fly spray. We didn't even know what it was. We used to burn cow or horse dung outside around the camp, the homes. Also burn gum leaves in a tin, a bucket, and smoke ourselves and inside of our homes when anyone passed away. Granny Rosie always carried a switch with her and made sure we all had one. A switch was a small branch broken off a gum tree, which we used to shoo the flies away with. The smoking of gum leaves was a tradition. It was done every time someone passed on. I hope that you will enjoy that story. Thank you.
And this is one of the stories. Did you get an award for this story?
I did. In the it's in the Pen magazine.
In is that a Mildura competition?
Yeah, it was a Mildura competition, and I got a special mention. It was what's his name? Tony Birch. Yeah. It was the Indigenous, Mildura Indigenous Writing Award 2016.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And was that one of the stories that you just read?
Yes, that was one of the stories.
And have you written many stories?
I have. I've written cotton wool sandwiches. I've written special banana. I've written about 50 stories that I've got. And,
great stories, and a great way to remember and record all those amazing times you had.
Yeah.
Would you like a glass of water?
No, I'm right, thanks. Yeah. But I'd just like to read one more story.
Yeah, that'd be great.
About my Uncle Paddy Black. It's called Black and White Time. If you didn't have a car and you wanted to travel anywhere, you had to catch a bus. My Uncle Paddy Black, who was as black as he had as it can be, had to go to Sydney on business. My dad had to go into town to do some chores for the manager. He got a lift on a mission truck with my dad from Mulbridge Mission. Dad dropped him at the post office to catch the bus to Cootamundra, and then he had to catch a train from there to Sydney. On his way back from Sydney on the train, he had to get off the train at Cootamundra to catch the connecting bus to take him to Lake Jellicoe. Uncle Paddy Black had to wait in Cootamundra for 2 hours for the bus to arrive. While he was sitting on the seat on the platform at the Cootamundra railway station waiting for the bus to arrive, an old white lady approached him. She asked him what the time was. He looked at his watch and told her the time. She then approached this old white fellow who was sitting at the end of the same seat and asked him what the time was. He told her exactly the same time as Uncle Paddy. The old white lady sat down on a seat just over from them. Uncle Paddy Black slowly got up off the seat and approached her. He then pointed to his watch and said to her, "Well, lady, now you've got it in black and white." The old white lady jumped up and took off into the cafeteria. She sat in the cafeteria until the bus arrived. Uncle Paddy chuckled to himself as he walked and sat on the seat. That old white lady got on the same bus as Uncle Paddy. She sat in the front seat behind the bus driver and kept a distance from Uncle Paddy Black. I think she may have been a bit scared of Uncle Paddy Black.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
Very clever, very funny.
Mm.
So when you were at Murrin Bridge, near Lake Cajalico, what school did you go to?
We had a school on the mission, on the Murrin Bridge mission, and I went to that school until they closed it down and took it to Yavlong West.
And what was that school like? Did you enjoy that?
I really enjoyed it, because they used to give us some sandwiches cocoa, hot cocoa. And we'd have, for lunch, and jam and Vegemite sandwiches.
And did you have any teachers you liked there?
Yeah, I liked all the teachers. They were very good to me. And I always top my class. I was always very academic, if that's what you say.
And enthusiastic about
your studies. I wanted to. I loved, history. I loved, my studies.
And was there any particular teacher that you really liked?
Mr. Wilding. He was our teacher that I liked, really liked him. Also, our principal, Mr. Clark. No, sorry, it wasn't Mr. Clark, he was our missionary. It was Mr. Smith, and he lived in the manager's quarters, or principal quarters, near the school.
And what did you like about him?
He really cared about us. They really cared about us. And they really wanted to help us. They were really, really good people. And
Was he the one you were telling me about who got a uniform for you, a school uniform?
No, that was Mr. Pollock. He was the principal at Lake Cajalico Central School.
So how old were you when you went to Lake Cajalico?
Oh, I must have been about 15, I think.
And what was the difference between the two schools? So you're in a school at the reserve or the mission, and then you went to Lake Cajalico with other white kids?
Well, it was a whole new different world. It was so different because everyone were the same on the mission. We never had any classes, we were all treated the same, we were all the same, we all shared. But when we went into the school at Lake Cajalico, it was just blew my mind.
In what way?
It was how they interacted with us, the white kids, like they didn't want nothing to do with us. I used to sit right in the back of the class, but my teacher, he favoured me a fair bit. He used to favour me a fair bit, my maths teacher, Mr. Summers, But I was treated really well, I must admit.
By the teachers?
By the teachers.
What about the other students?
Yeah, they treated them really well, but I think it was just the kids, they sort of looked down at us. And they used to spit at us and all that sort of stuff,
And how would you get from the mission to the school?
My father used to drive the mission truck, we call it. It was a shit truck. It was a truck that Dad used to cart the rubbish on, go around and collect the rubbish from the houses and take to the tip, and he had to clean out the toilets, empty the toilet pans, them old toilet pans. And we used to get tar on our clothes and on our shoes and stuff. And because we had to travel on that same truck.
And how far was it to school from?
9 miles. And it was an open truck. So we used to freeze.
Dusty and dirty.
And it was dead road then. And we just cuddle up to each other on the back of the truck to keep each other warm.
How many of you were there that went in on the truck?
I'm not too sure. I think about maybe 30 of us. Could be more. I'm not too sure.
And so what age did you go to before you left school? What year did you go to?
I went to year 10. That was in 1968. I got my school certificate. I was the first Aboriginal person to get my school certificate to go through. And I also was elected as a prefect. And my name is still up in the school, in the central school in Lake Angelica, as a prefect.
You must have been very proud.
Yeah, I was very proud, yeah. And I was very athletic. I used to play a lot of sport. We used to go to Sydney to play basketball. We were the top team. I used to play hockey. Yeah. But, you know, when Dad used to take us into town to school every morning, and we'd say to him, "Dad, please pull up the road," because we didn't want to jump out where the bus was pulled up, because it was shame for us, you know. We shouldn't have been ashamed.